It's the best time of the year. Football season.
Atlanta keeps it runs. 20-15 to the 10 to the 5. Touchdown, Joel Lanning!
Your number one source for Cyclones football. It's former Cyclones talking Cyclones on CycloneFanatic.com.
Lanning out of the shotgun, looking to throw. He fires to the end zone for Daly. Touchdown, Iowa State!
This is Barely Audible with Jeff Woody, Zach Spears, and Austin Arnott on CycloneFanatic.com.
Ah, yes, welcome on into this week's edition of Barely Audible right here on CycloneFanatic.com. I'm former Cyclone offensive lineman Zach Spears, and we'll be joined shortly by former Cyclone greats running back Jeff Woody and the quarterback Austin Arnott. Plenty to talk about this week with the Iowa State Cyclones going on the road and losing 27-6 to the University of Texas down there in Austin. The offense failed to show up for most of the game, just getting us 6 points after playing really well the previous 3 weeks. And why are the quarterbacks swapping in and out still? I thought we were done with that. And whose fault was it for all the sacks? And the defense got torched in the second half. But who's really to blame for that? Then also, as you know, it is a bye week, so there's no game to preview, but we do have a very special treat for you. My buddy, Nick Wright of Fox Sports 1, he fills in on the herd for Colin Cowherd, works for them in television and in radio, national radio host, joins us for the show in the second part of the show, and he talks everything with us. He talks Big 12 expansion, talks NFL, NBA, the new look Warriors, and he jumps in and even does this week's gambling picks with us. So stay tuned for that. We'll talk a little Texas now with Jeff and Austin, and then Nick joins the three of us to talk everything and more. All right, guys. So I was feeling really good, all high and mighty about this Iowa State football team after the last 3 or 4 weeks, and especially where the offense was and defense was playing all right, especially in the first half. And then the defense shows up the first half again and then stays in the locker room at halftime. And what in the hell happened to this offense, Jeff Woody?
It was, I think, two things. One is when you play a team like Texas, who has the athletes they do, you sort of kind of panic, and I think the offensive line did that, where I don't think that they played, like, that they're incapable of playing. Like, physically, I don't think they're incapable of being competitive with Texas. I don't think you're going to beat Texas's defensive line with our offensive line, like the Jimmys and Joes.
Yeah.
But from a technique perspective, there were plays like Lanning was able to step up in the pocket and deliver a strike, even though it wasn't blocked perfectly. And there were times when Mike or Montgomery got like found a hole, found an alley, even though it wasn't blocked perfectly. But I think for the majority of the game, they watched film and they saw like, oh my God, this guy's like 6'3", 320. Like I have to come at him and hit him with everything I got. And then all of a sudden your technique goes to shit. And so I think that's one part of it. I think the other part of it is just emotionally, I didn't know, like, I don't think they had and prepared with as much emotion or juice that they did weeks before. And you could absolutely see it on Saturday that San Jose State, you get up and you win, and Baylor, you have a high amount of juice and you play great and then you lose. And then you have to talk yourself into practice against Oklahoma State and you play great and then you lose. And then you have to try and talk yourself back into Texas, and they just didn't have the same oomph in practice, and they just came out blah in the game.
Austin, what did you see out of the offense in the game?
Yeah, you know, you look at the always a telltale sign for me with the offense, especially with, you know, the quarterback play and really trying to monitor that with our offense, is third down conversions. 6 of 18, not good enough. Not going to get it done. Another thing
also,
I looked at too.
That's a lot of third downs.
Yeah.
Like, it's a bad percentage, but that's a lot of third downs.
Yeah, I mean, that goes to allude to the point we talked about earlier in the year, are how good are we doing on first and second down to solidify maybe a chance of getting a third and medium to short. So that was frustrating. And then less than 100 yards rushing. That goes into what you were saying, Jeff, with the offensive line being a little bit overmatched mentally and physically. So didn't have the proper rushing yards we wanted to. But then, you know, the 8 sacks definitely takes away from that. So
yeah,
you know, half glass half full, half empty type scenario. And there just seemed to be no rhythm.
Yeah.
You know, we get something going. We have a couple plays in a row, and then a penalty or an error, MA, something like that, where we forget what we're doing, and then we're right back where we started at, you know, behind the chains. So those things right there piled up to, especially in the second half, to what went wrong with the Cyclone Saturday.
Austin, you were talking about rhythm, and I don't want to steal Zach's thunder, but from my eyes, Lanning was the better player. Lanning was and has been the better quarterback, whether that's being a better player or not, but the offense looks distinctly better when 7's in the game as opposed to when 10's in the game. And I think this week it got clunky rotating him in and out. Did you see the same thing from quarterback to quarterback, or what was your assumption of the reason why the rhythm was bad?
Yeah, I think that has a huge part to do with it, and I'm glad we're touching on this now early on. The way they rotated him, it did not make sense to me. You had Lanning come in. Was it the first three or four drives Lanning had?
Yeah, all of the first quarter. I think Parks' first series was the first series of the second quarter, I think, was Parks.
It seems like they almost went in quarters this time as opposed to, you know, series and who had the hot end. Well, you know, you're kicking field goals and not scoring touchdowns. I understand going back and forth, but it didn't make sense to me for them to stick with Park because he wasn't doing anything off the charts that was, you know, incredible. I mean, yeah, sure, like we talked about in the past, he's probably the better thrower of the two. But I think that offense has run so much better the last three games with Joe Lanning in there. It really, really a head scratcher to me. I couldn't tell you as to why or from my standpoint what I saw that made Park that much better. I didn't see that. So I'm looking at it and seeing, okay, why is Lanning still not in the game? Still not in the game? Still not in the game? And then towards the end, you know, it just seemed like they wanted to stick with Park and keep him in there, which I did not agree with.
I thought that Lanning got completely out of his rhythm. Not that his rhythm was great, but they did get 6 points in the first quarter. I thought that the quarterback subbing in and out got Lanning completely out of his rhythm. And for that, how you watch an offense, and especially as much as we watch this team, you can kind of get into the rhythm and feel the rhythm and see it with not only in the quarterback, but the entire offense and the whole team as a whole. And I thought in the second half, everybody was out of sync, and I thought a lot of it had to do with the quarterback play. And obviously that doesn't help yanking the quarterback. I felt like, especially Saturday, when Park went in there, I was like, okay, why is Park in the game? It just looked like to me, and then consistently throughout the rest of the game, that they were wanting to find situations to put Park in the game to see something there. And I thought we had already done this experiment. I thought we were already done with it.
But to take a little bit of the coach's side of it, Joel did not play exceptionally well. And it could have been a rhythm thing, but he was holding on to the ball. I mean, 8 sacks, three to four of those are on more on Joel than they are the offensive line, where you can't, you know, like the sack that he took, and I know it was garbage time, but they're on the 3-yard line going in, and it was the last play of the game. I think it was either the last play of the game or last play of the drive or whatever it was, you know, that last minute where they're trying to score a touchdown, which would have sent Musburger over the edge if that was going on.
Yep.
But both tackles and one of the guards cut, and Joel hung onto the ball for 3 seconds. And the line cut blocks, that ball has to be gone, whether you throw it through the uprights or you throw it into somebody's hands. You can't hold that ball because there's nobody to block anybody anymore. So Joel didn't play particularly well, and I don't know what the reason was, but I don't know if it was like if they're using Park as like a prod to get Joel going or something. I don't know. I didn't like either one from the second quarter on.
What, Jeff? Keep going, Austin. Keep.
No, I just said I was going to agree with Jeff, and that's kind of what we're building onto next is that O line play. Jeff said 3 or 4. I would argue and say 5 or 6 of those plays are on the quarterback. Park and Lanning both. I mean, that's been their MO since the beginning of the year. We've talked about this since game one. One, you got to have that mental clock. As a quarterback, the most important thing you can do is make smart, keyword, fast decisions. We made not smart. We made not very competent, slow reads for a lot of that game. And you can see the outcome, 6 points. So we always talk about the quarterback in an offense like we have. Sure, it's a heavy run emphasis, but in an offense like we have, the quarterback dictates the tempo. He's getting the play from the sideline. He is in charge. He is the culprit of what the offense should be. He is the reason the offense is running. And when we're held onto the ball and taking too long, like you said, if we're seeing guys cut in front of him, that ball needs to be out quick. understandably, and it was not. So I can argue and say that three quarters of those eight sacks were on the quarterbacks and just holding on to the ball too long.
Yeah, if my memory serves me correctly, I think I was shaking my head a few times at Park, just holding it too long and taking sacks, not trying to get out of it and get out of the pocket and to at least throw the ball away. So I think you're onto something there, Austin. And Jeff, this defense, the defense got torched in the second half after playing really well. And over the going into halftime, over the last six quarters, they'd only given up 3 points to the University of Texas, which on the surface just sounds insane. And then in the second half, Texas comes out and had nearly 400 yards of offense. And our defense gave up 24 points in the second half, as well as 27 points straight to the Longhorns. What happened?
It's you got to put this on the offense, partially. When you're out there for so long, something's going to break. You know, you take a sledgehammer to a concrete wall. You swing it once, you swing it twice, you swing it three times, it ain't cracking through. You give a sledgehammer 15 cracks in the same spot to get through a wall, it's going to get through. So at some point, the offense has to stay on the field to give the defense a chance to make adjustments, to coach on what happened. Because there were really, outside of two big plays, the defense played really well. Because there was two big touchdown passes, one to Hurd and then one to, was it number four, on the yeah. right hash.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
when they ran a little out and up. Outside of those two big touchdowns, the defense gave up 10 points. And, right, 10 points in the second half, and they get three in the first half. So it would have been 13. Which, if you do 13 against a team that's been scoring 35, 40 points a game, like, that's good. They held Texas to, I think, their lowest point output of the season, didn't they?
And right.
And played an incredible first half.
And awesome. Played a great first half.
Awesome first half.
So it's just, again, like, go back to that, you know, my mind works on analogies. You give enough swings of a sledgehammer into a concrete wall, that thing's going to come through. So the offense just has to do a better job of staying on the field so you can make adjustments, so you can make you can give the defense a break, so you can get those eight defensive linemen that we're playing the chance to breathe so we don't have to play all eight on every single drive.
Austin, you have anything to add about the defense?
The one thing I wanted to add is they're, I mean, everything, the first half they played incredible. I mean, Texas was doing a couple of things that, you know, weren't beneficial to themselves as far as penalties were going, but I think they played phenomenal as a unit. So, and it's hard, and Jeff alluded to it perfectly, it's hard to keep that pace up, especially when Texas was getting a short field, the offense was not doing what they were supposed to be doing. And if you guys didn't notice, Texas has sped up that offense. They are going. They're going, yep. going, going. Yep. So that was hard. When you're on the field, I mean, it comes to, like it always is Iowa State, the best defense is sometimes a good offense. And keeping mm-hmm. that defense, keeping our defense on the sideline for a little bit and getting those guys rest, because they're going to be on the field a lot of time during second halves when the game's on the line. So the number one thing we got to do is sustain. And it's not easy to do with the amount of talent that we have as far as depth goes. But those guys played the best two quarters of the year by far. Mm-hmm. So that was fun to see.
What, Jeff, so we've talked about the negatives. What positives did you see on both sides of the ball? Obviously, Colin Downing, the punter, he punted tremendously. I hate having that
Man,
be my bright spot
that.
And bragging about that. But I thought he gave us a shot to win the football game on Saturday with the way he punted the football. But besides that, on offensive defense, what positives can you take away from Saturday?
So I think the positives that I got is our linebackers are getting markedly better.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, so to take that outside of just one position group, tackling has improved significantly from even a month ago. Don't even go back to the start of the season, but a month ago, tackling has improved drastically, because that running back ain't easy to bring down. I mean, he's a big SOB. He's what, 6'1", 240?
Yeah, he's a big old dude.
He's a big dude.
Talented.
And to bring him down, that's not easy. And Iowa State did it really effectively throughout the entire game. And that was, one guy would hit and they would wrap, and then his buddies would come to tackle. So that was a positive. And then to go back to the linebackers, our defensive line was getting more penetration, which allowed the linebackers to play freer, and then they were reacting quicker to when they had those free reads. So it was the defense, for the most part, played a lot better. And then my positive on the other side of the ball, god damn, DeShante Jones is good.
He's really good.
God
awesome.
Damn,
especially for a freshman. He's good for anybody in the Big 12, but especially for a freshman.
You know who he reminds me of? And this is high praise, and don't take this as me saying he's going to end up this way.
Tavon Austin.
But he reminds me of Tavon Austin.
Were you really about to say that?
Yeah, Tavon Austin. Tavon Austin and Stedman Bailey. Those guys, they're so quick that – so when defenses have to look at Iowa State right now, they have to account for number five. And where is he at? Because he's more powerful and more physical than you at every position. Number eight, and a better route runner, you can't cover him. So it's this two sides of the same coin with number five and number eight on offense. And DeShante Jones is a freshman. So he's just going to continue to get better. And the more he understands football, then that kid's going to be able to do whatever he wants to do to a secondary because he's going to know exactly where to be.
Hey, I hope he's as fast as Tavon Austin. My goodness. That guy can scoot.
Well, he can certainly make plays like Tavon Austin because he's already doing it in the Big 12, which is, you know, a high-level conference. Like, I don't – Tavon Austin's senior year was the first year in the Big 12. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But Jones is certainly making plays at this high level. Austin – your positives, obviously we already went on the negatives. What are the good things that you take away from Saturday's game on the offense and defense?
It goes back to that defense. And that unit played so well the first two quarters. Now, my big thing with the Cyclones, and I tweeted this, you know, when are we going to put a full game together? When are we going to put four quarters together? When that happens, obviously this team can be, as we've seen, can be pretty good. We've been good a quarter here, good a quarter there. But if this team, you know, and they'll learn this as time goes, like we talk about, can't change culture overnight with Coach Campbell. But this team, I mean, this team going forward, when they can put it all together, I mean, we've seen that they're usually in the right positions at the right time. It's just got to be all on the same page. I mean, four full quarters of playing hard, and it's hard to do. That's why, you know, you only get 12 opportunities in the season. It's hard to do so. So I'm excited for that. Another positive that I saw, I mean, the guy that keeps showing up, Brian Peavy, just keeps showing up every Saturday. Yep. Keeps showing up. Sophomore. 5'8", undersized, young, you know, slow, whatever you want to call him. The kid keeps showing up, and he'll come and put a lick on you, too. So I like that kid a lot.
All right, guys, so it's the bye week, so we have no game on Saturday to preview for you, but we do have a special treat, an awesome guest, FS1's Nick Wright, the Nick Wright, my boy Nick Wright. Nick, man, thank you so much for joining us out there in L.A. We really appreciate it. You remembering us, your Midwest roots. You're from Kansas City. You're jumping on with some people up on north of I-35 from it. We appreciate it, buddy.
Absolutely. I'm excited to be on. Thanks for having me.
Ain't no problem. So, as you know, I'm Zach Spears, Austin Arnaud, the former quarterback, and Jeff Woody scored the big touchdown against number two Oklahoma State to win it. You actually tweeted that night. I was banned from Twitter, and you tweeted, you're like –
#FreeZachLapedia.
Yeah, #FreeZachLapedia. You said, congratulations to the win and my boy Zach Lapedia. Unfortunately, he cannot be tweeting tonight because his coach takes away his liberties as an American. So, yeah, so so the three of us, we all played for Coach Tom Herman. He was our offense coordinator at Iowa State.
Oh, wow. I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, so
we got to go there early. Yeah. We got to go there early, it's, Nick.
Just to welcome you on board, we're going to bring up that.
So yeah. My thing is he's blowing up and he's doing great things, obviously. Did you guys ever make up from that? I know you offered to take him to lunch, and he kind of played along with it on Twitter. Did you guys ever make up on any of that type stuff, or are you guys still at a distance?
All right, to be clear, he didn't play along at all on Twitter otherwise.
Shocker.
His wife played along a little bit. No, we've never spoken again. But I have no ill will there. Like, he was angry, I think mostly at my co-host, John Lopez, and that anger then translated to me, and, like, that's fine. I'm not, to be totally honest, I'm not entirely certain who was right in the argument, he or John, but that didn't really matter to me. I was defending my guy. If people who are listening don't know, like, the guy that I used to do radio with in Houston reported that he had met with a quarterback who may transfer. He took issue with the word meet. Like, does meet, what does it mean? And so we got, it was a little bit of a testy interview. But no, we've never spoken again. I do think what is a shame for University of Houston fans is, with the Big 12 not expanding and that news coming down this week, I feel like it is an absolute guarantee that now they're going to lose him as their head coach mm-hmm. because I don't think he's going to stay at a non-Power 5 school.
Yeah,
absolutely. And speaking of that realignment talk, Nick, Austin here, my opinion, and I kind of fall on the same lines with a lot of guys who talk about this stuff, where do you see the Big 12 going? I mean, you can add a couple teams. Does that water the league down? If you stay at 10, there's no conference championship. Where do you stand at on that issue?
Well, it would appear to me that Texas, Oklahoma, and the television networks, none of them want it to expand, which to me means there is no chance that it will expand. Like, it's really that simple. It doesn't really matter, with no disrespect, what Iowa State or Kansas or anyone wants. The television networks, my boss, Eric Shanks, the president of Fox, came out and said he didn't want them to expand. I think it's pretty clear that Texas sees very little, if no value, to adding a school like University of Houston, that it just hurts them. So as long as the power brokers don't have really any impetus for it to expand, then I don't think it will. And I don't know what good at, like, you add Houston, what, fine, you're not adding a television market.
Right.
It's Houston's already there. And then other than that, like, what school are you going to add? Like, adding Cincinnati or UConn? Like, how does that make the conference better? I don't know that it does.
Yeah, and I think this is Woody here. Yeah, I don't think you're hurting anybody's feelings by saying Iowa State isn't as much of a player. And I think what's interesting about that is, I don't know if you've recognized any quotes from Jamie Pollard. He's a very candid guy. And on a radio show in the Des Moines area, one of the things that he said is he used George Niang to Iowa State fans, you know, the Karl Malone Power Forward Player of the Year last year. Right. He said, Texas and Oklahoma are the George Niang of our team, where, of course, are we on the team? Yeah, but I want to be a part of a team that has power players. So it's Iowa State recognizing the fact that Texas and Oklahoma are the decision makers on it. To kind of ask a question, because you're more associated, more understanding of the media than I guess us Midwestern idiots are. Was this any part? Is there any chance that this was kind of a long con by the Big 12 to understand that they never really had a huge intention to expand, but once they saw the ACC network get the money they had, and then they knew the clause in their contract that if they did expand, they would get a certain amount of money. Is there any way that they knew they weren't going to expand to kind of put this on to essentially get a short-term amount of money out of the networks that they normally wouldn't have gotten if they did expand or stayed pat?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question, and just to be totally honest, I don't know the answer to that. I did radio in Kansas City from 2007 until 2012, and it feels like basically from the mid, like around 2009 until now, the specter of conference realignment has been hanging over the sports of college football and basketball, and I just don't. I've never known what is real and what is not. Like, I remember there not that long ago being a belief that the Big 12 could go away entirely, and that if that were to happen, like, could a school such as Kansas be left out in the cold because it doesn't have, a big television base, and B, a relevant football team? I've never known if that was just fear-mongering or real. Like, I don't know what's real. I remember when there was discussion that Texas could join the Pac-12 or even the SEC, and that all always seemed crazy to me. So I that's a long way of saying I have no idea. I've never known really what's real and what's fake when it comes to conference realignment.
So with, again, to play an outsider's perspective, what is the perception of the Big 12 conference nationally? Because as Cyclones, we understand that, like, we like our conference, but what's the perception of the Big 12 from a national level?
I think when you talk basketball, people think of the ACC. Well, they used to think of the Big East, and now they think of the ACC. I think when you talk football, people think of the SEC, the Pac-12, maybe the Big Ten. I think the Big 12 of the Power 5 conferences is right now, it is clearly to me on a tier below where the Big 10, the SEC, and the Pac-12 are. Like, it's not like it's a mid-majors, but I also think football-wise, you don't look at it as a power, and basketball-wise, you look at it as it's Kansas and everybody else.
So I want to shift gears now. We talked college football stuff with you. Now I want to get in your wheelhouse. Your top three things, yep. NFL, NBA, and some gambling. You and Austin could probably do a whole damn show on gambling together. But NFL stuff. Austin lives in Charlotte. We have an old teammate who plays for the Panthers. What the hell's wrong with the Panthers? Are they this bad, or is this just a funk they're going through?
Yeah, like, I think it's a little bit of everything. I think that, you know, if you look at this year, so they're 1-5. And that's awful, especially when they were 15-1 last year. But, you know, Denver's really good. Week one, they have Denver beat, and they kick a field goal to win the game. And Kubiak calls timeout. They have to kick it again, and they miss it. There's a loss. They lost a game a couple weeks ago. Oh, God, I forgot who they were playing. It was a nationally televised game when Cam was injured. I forgot who they were playing, but it was they lose a game that they easily could have won with a healthy Cam. They end up losing by, I think, a field goal.
Was that Atlanta?
He's not in.
Was it Atlanta?
Yeah, Falcons. Matt Jones knocked him out.
Right. So the following week is when I'll pull it up right now. Like they lost this past weekend a game that against the Saints where they're tied halfway through it. So like 1-5 very easily could be 3-3 or even 4-2. Like, that's just they just haven't had the breaks go their way this year. It was to Tampa that they lost
Bucks
on Monday night.
Right, on Monday night,
after Cam got knocked out against Atlanta. So I think some of it's bad luck. I think some of it is they totally underestimated how important Josh Norman was. And I also think that it is very hard to overstate how hard it is to come back from losing the Super Bowl when you haven't won a Super Bowl before, because football's such a long, physically devastating season. And the sample sizes are so small in that players know that, you know, how difficult it is to make it to a Super Bowl. And that you can be a great team and just get unlucky, the way I feel like the Patriots did last season. You know, you miss an extra point in the conference championship game. And I think when you're 15-1, you dominate the regular season, you crush two teams in the postseason, and you go into a Super Bowl that I still feel like if they were to go back and play that Super Bowl 10 times, the Panthers win 7 of them. The Broncos just got that one. I think it's really hard to start back over week one the following year and say, okay, go do it all over again to have that same chance. I just think if you remember last season, the Seahawks, after they had their hearts ripped out in a tough Super Bowl loss, they started out 2-4.
Yeah.
And they ended up rallying at the end. But I just think it's really hard to come back from that. And if I'm being fair, Cam, who I love, not only has he not improved, he has regressed greatly.
Yeah.
And it somehow Kelvin Benjamin coming around hasn't helped them. It seems to have hurt them. So all those things have conspired to make a team that should be one of the best teams in football just objectively be one of the worst teams in football.
So I'm not going to ask you – obviously, I'm in Dallas, and I'm a huge Cowboys fan, lifelong fan, and covered them for a while. And I'm not going to ask you Dak or Romo because, A, you can listen to you on The Herd. You can check you out on The Herd on FS1 or follow you on Twitter at GetNickWright. I suggest you do. If you're not already following them, you're missing out. Go follow them. So I'm not going to ask you Dak or Romo because you could figure that out easily by listening to you or watching on TV or following on Twitter. I'm going to ask you, if we go back and redraft this past draft from April or May – does Dak go number one overall already? I feel like we have this conversation every 5-10 years of drafts of 5-10 years in the past, but not
what
3 months after,
question.
Not 3 months right after the draft, because Wentz has been great too. And also, Dak fits in really well to what the Cowboys can do and what they're built to do. But does any team take Dak number one overall right now?
Oh, yes. I mean, let me put it like this. I think we are kind of parsing if we're debating, you know, is it Dak or Rome, or is it Dak or Prescott 1-2? Here's, I think, a better way to the way I would put it. If you went back and redrafted, I think you can make a strong argument that the Dallas Cowboys ended up with two of the top three players in this draft.
Yeah,
no doubt.
Right? Like, if you went back and redrafted, it's either going Wentz 1, Dak 2, or Dak 1, Wentz 2, probably depending on the preference of the team, right?
Yep.
Like, I think you can make a case for either guy. I think Wentz has shown maybe some more elite high-level throws.
Yeah.
But I also think that maybe he has the last few weeks shown a little vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And I'll be totally honest with you. If you go back and I almost said Trevor Siemian, but Siemian was 2 years ago. Yeah. I keep forgetting. Like, I think he was – I would keep forgetting. It was Paxton Lynch this year and Siemian 2 years ago. But the Dak thing has been remarkable to me. And I know you said you're not going to ask me, but I'm going to just give a quick recap of kind of where I'm at with this. I'm a huge Romo fan. I think Romo's an unfairly scrutinized player. I think he's an outstanding player. But I wouldn't change. I would stick with Dak, and the reason is threefold, just quickly. One, I think it's what the players want and expect you to do. That's the least important reason, but it matters a little bit. Two, I think it's a lot easier to stick with Dak, and if he struggles, then go to Romo. Then I think that's an easy thing. I think it's very hard to take Dak out, go to Romo. If Romo struggles, then to go back to Dak. I think that's very difficult. And finally, if you take Dak out and you go with Romo, you've got to realize you are hoping by doing that, if you are hoping that Dak does not see the field for the next 2 years. Like, you're hoping Romo's healthy. You're hoping Romo's awesome. And that would mean you don't get to find out if Dak really is this good. I would use as much of this season as I can to see if Dak is this great. And if he is this great, then all of a sudden in this offseason, you can ask yourself, is it worth trading Romo? Because the Cowboys have used the first round of the draft better than any team in football the last 7 years.
Yep.
They've got Dez, Tyron Smith, Zach Martin, Travis Frederick, Ezekiel Elliott.
The Vikings, Nick.
the Vikings, hold on, but here's the thing about the Vikings. So the Cowboys, since 2010... the Cowboys have got four Pro Bowlers out of the first round. It'll be five with Ezekiel Elliott. The Vikings have gotten five Pro Bowlers out of the first round. But the Vikings have done it with 10 first-round picks since 2010. The Cowboys only had seven.
And the Cowboys got Lyle Collins and Jalen Smith and Randy Gregory, all first-round grades outside of the first round.
Absolutely. And Dak Prescott in the fourth round. Yeah. So if you're the Cowboys and you draft, especially in the first round, really well, I mean, if Sam Bradford gets you a first and a fourth, then Tony Romo gets you a first and a second.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not saying you have to trade Tony. What I'm saying is give Dak a dozen games. And if he's awesome, then stick with him. If he's not awesome, then you go to Tony down the stretch run. You still have a great chance of winning the division. And then you're fine, whatever it is, what it is. But if Dak is awesome, then you see what the Jets would give you for Tony Romo. And if next year you can add two first-round picks to the defense, plus Jalen Smith comes back, which is, I know, a big if, but God, he was great in college. And Randy Gregory, if he can get his life together, all of a sudden that's a damn good defense.
Yep.
Yeah, and I think The other aspect of the whole Romo thing is, at any point, your game plan has to be contingent on the fact that any hit can completely take him out of the game. And I mean that sort of tongue-in-cheek, but sort of not, you know? Where
he slides
to avoid a hit and gets hit in the back and is out.
And I just I keep going back to this. I see no downside to sticking with Dak. Because if he's bad, you can then go to Romo. I think it's incredibly difficult to go to Romo if he's bad, rusty, or gets injured, to then say, hey, Dak, you know that great role you were on and how we loved you? Go do it again. I think that's just hard to ask any player, much less a rookie.
Yeah, we got to find out if he's Tom Brady or Brock Osweiler.
Yeah, for sure.
So we're talking about the Cowboys, which have the biggest draw in the country. Why is there such a dip in watching across the nation? Because I am – the whole Trump-Hillary thing, I'm not buying that for a second, that that's the reason why there's a ratings dip. But even the teams like the Cowboys and the Packers that generally draw really well, everybody's down. Why is – you're in L.A. Why is that happening?
So a couple things that I think are noteworthy. Fox – and I'm not saying this because I work for Fox. Fox is actually not down. And that is because Fox has had – we've been very lucky. The Cowboys have been very good. Odell's been interesting. We've had some good games and compelling storylines. But in general, football's way down. I understand that people are saying it's because there's protests. That's a lie. And here's how I know it's a lie, other than common sense. The number of people watching NFL games is steady. The length that people are spending watching the games is what has dipped. So the protest thing doesn't make sense, right? Because it's not that fewer people are watching, it's that people are watching for a shorter amount of time. I think the answer is I think it's threefold. One, I do think the election has something to do with it. I wake up every morning, and the first thing I do is check Twitter. Now I'm very political, but the last 6 weeks, when I check Twitter, I don't scroll my feed. I go to, like, my six favorite political follows to see what the hell happened while I was sleeping, any latest poll, what's going on. That is where my mind's at. I think that's where a lot of the country's mind's at. So that's point one. Point two, that it couldn't go up forever, right? Ratings were just up, 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 up. Eventually, they're going to come back down. But point three, and this is the one that I think is the hardest for the league to swallow, but I just think it's objectively true. The football hasn't been good. Like, the quality of games is down. And I don't know who you blame for that. Maybe it's just Peyton retired and Brady was suspended and this. Maybe it's because, as I think, the way they have changed the rules so much in an attempt to make offense, 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 it's neutered the defense, and all of a sudden you don't have enough good quarterbacks to make that offense work. But I also think that Mark Cuban was right to a degree, which is, you know, what is it that, like,
pigs get fed, hogs get slaughtered.
Yes, exactly right. And at some point, I do wonder if people are a little oversaturated on the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, when there's a NFL game on now, every Thursday, every Monday, all day Sunday, some Sundays it starts at 6 a.m. because of the London game, plus the it just feels to me, and I'm going to add one other thing. I also, like, I enjoy, like, I find the way the ethos of the NBA respectable, enjoyable. I like the way the league is run. I like the people who run it. I think the NFL has hurt itself by being run at times by people that we think are dicks. And it's just like, you know what? Like, I don't know that I want to root for a league that, like, it just, something feels funny. Like, oh, so, like, those great military tributes you were doing, you were charging the Department of Defense.
Yeah, right.
That's
yeah.
Cool. And, oh, we're going to, we are going to just cravenly and clearly exploit every last, you know, you want to perform at the Super Bowl, you got to pay us. And, oh, yeah, by the way, we are going to, in what I think is clearly got a racial component to it, we are going to crack down on celebrations as if they are the scourge of the world, because we have a league that is run by overwhelmingly white people, and we are going to say, because let's listen, black people and white people go to church differently, a lot of us eat differently, we get married differently, and I know it makes people uncomfortable, but it's true, black people and white people celebrate differently. And all of a sudden,
yep.
The way black folks celebrate is against the rules. And I know that's an oversimplification, but there is a component to that. And there's always this very uncomfortable feeling I get where I see, and I see this especially in college football as well, where you have like the old white ref policing the young black boy. It just feels uncomfortable. And now it's gotten to such an extreme point where we're told you can't pantomime a bow and arrow because it's a violent act, as if we're at the turn of the century old west. Like, there's just a spate of bow and arrow crimes going on. Like, it's just, I feel like the drip, drip, drip of all these things come together, and then all of a sudden you add that people are just consuming television differently, and you add that people do have more options, and you add that there are other things going on in the world, and I think some people have said, and I'm going to say one other thing, while... Pardon me. I understand that they tell you the number of people who watch Red Zone, it's such a small number compared to the general national audience. That's not affecting ratings. It's not that too many people are watching Red Zone. I believe that. But what I think they're not factoring in is this. Red Zone's been around long enough that you have a generation of people that have watched Red Zone for 10 years. And if you've been watching Red Zone for the last decade, you know what all of a sudden is pretty damn boring? Watching one football game.
Yeah.
Like, it is hard. I watch Red Zone, and then I find myself when it's Sunday night, and there's just the one game. I'm like, bro, there's commercials and all these breaks and all this stuff. Like, that game better kick ass, because I just, for 7 hours... just had a football orgy with no commercials, no downtime, nothing.
They listened to Collinsworth say that the Texans are good and that game Sunday night was good. Collinsworth saying that was incredible, by the way. That game was not good.
No, it was. Well, that's something a lot of people do, which is they confuse a close finish with a good football game. Like, no, right. By any objective measure, that was not good.
Yeah, I'm just going to come back to one thing that you said. Like, to tie together the... I don't trust the ownership and the celebrations thing. And I think to me, one of the reasons why I'm looking at it is there's a huge hypocrisy. And I remember what Katie Nolan said with the whole Greg Hardy thing of like, you're not going to discipline strong enough a guy that threw a woman onto a pile of guns, but you're going to fine somebody $100,000 for pretending to shoot an arrow. And it's one of those things where you don't, like you said, like Adam Silver generally seems like he's got his priorities on straight. But then Goodell goes after the thing that he shouldn't go after and ignores the thing that he should because it's, quote, better for business.
Well, that's a whole – and again, that's a whole other thing, which is the NFL decided – we and Goodell decided in particular, I want to be the punishment commissioner. I want to be in the punishment business, and he's been bad at it, and – This is what will make some people uncomfortable, but when Goodell was just, messing all over himself repeatedly from, it was like Bounty Gate was so bad his old boss had to come in and fix it, and then there was the fake refs, and then there was Ray Rice, and then there was Adrian Peterson, and then there was Deflategate. His shield was, but revenues are up and ratings are up. Revenues are up and ratings are up. And I used to scream from the mountaintops that giving Roger Goodell credit for NFL ratings is giving the bartender on Daytona Beach credit for the spring break crowd. It's going to be there with or without him. But everyone said, no. That's what matters and it's up. Well, by the way, if that's the case, then this year, even though there's been no commissioner controversies, people should be at his doorstep, right? Yeah. Like, if all he was bad at didn't matter, because all that mattered were ratings and revenues, well, then now the fact that he hasn't screwed anything up, that shouldn't matter, because what matters is ratings and revenues.
Yeah. Mm. And speaking of screwing stuff up, I want to move to the NBA and the Golden State Warriors because, as we all know, they did screw up a 3-1 lead in the NBA Finals with the only unanimous MVP ever. I mean, so I want to talk about the new look Warriors roster, Nick. 2016, 2017, obviously they've added Kevin Durant, and they added him while you were on air on the 4th of July, I believe, or right before you went on air on the 4th of July there. They added Kevin Durant. What do you expect this roster to look like on the floor? Do you expect them to gel right away, or is it going to be like a Heatles effect, like when LeBron first joined the Heat with Bosch and Dwayne Wade? Is it going to take some time for them to gel together?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that Heat team started like 10 and 11. I don't think it'll be anything like that. I mean, this team lost 9 games all of last year. But I do think that this is a tremendous risk. And I say that because if, with 1 minute left in the season, that's a tie game, and they are 1 minute away from completing the greatest 2-year stretch in NBA history. Mm-hmm. 1 minute away from the most wins any team has had over 2 years, from 2 championships, 2 MVPs, a unanimous MVP, the greatest start to a season ever, the greatest, I think it was like road record ever. It was ever the greatest everything, right?
Yep. In the MVP.
And they lose. They lose. And what they end up doing is drastically overhauling their entire roster. Of their top 11 guys in minutes, 6 of them are gone. I find that interesting. Now, they did that to get the guy who I believe to be the second best player in the sport behind LeBron. So it is hard to say that's the wrong thing to do. But it's a risky thing. And Harrison Barnes took 10 shots a game last year. Kevin Durant took 19 shots a game last year. Those 9 shots got to come from somebody, right?
Yep.
So
who are they coming from? And are they coming from Clay? Because I think Clay's ready to be a true superstar. Are they coming from Steph? Because is Steph going to be cool with going into the NBA Finals? Steph was the consensus best player in the world. A lot of, like, and I say consensus because that's where the media had gone with it. Now he's not the consensus best player on his own team.
Yeah.
Like,
correct.
Draymond had a very checkered offseason. He slapped a kid at Michigan State. He tweeted out a picture of his penis. He played terribly in the Olympics. Is he going to be cool with being minimized? And it is impossible they start better than they did last year. Last year they started 24-0. So let's say they start 10-4, which is really good.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, is there going to be feelings in the locker room? Why do we change anything? Why'd we do that? Why'd we do this? Like, I think it's risky. Now, it's possible that what they've done is they're the first team in league history with 4 of the 12 best players ever, with 4 of the 12 best players in the league, that they will be unguardable, and that none of this will matter. But that was a petrifying team last year that took the second greatest player in the history of the sport, having the greatest 3-game stretch in the history of his career. It took that for them to win by the skin of their teeth. And they drastically changed everything. And I think what LeBron's, I think all year long, Greg Popovich is going to be preparing to try to beat them up down low in a 7-game series. And I think all season long, LeBron's going to try to convince Kyrie, you're the best point guard in the NBA. You're better than Steph. You're the guy. And guess what? Come the finals, you're better than Steph. I'm better than Durant. Fight me. Let's go. And, like, I think that's all in play. And What I do know is this. Now, I'm an unabashed LeBron James fan, but this is just, to me, no matter who you're a fan of, objectively true. What's best for the league, anything is good for the league as long as the Warriors don't win this year. Like, the Heat were super interesting because they lost year one. If they win year one, then the other two championships seem too easy, right? Like, if the Warriors could win three of the next four as long as they lose the first one. Like, if the Warriors lose the first one, then year two is for the entire blueprint, right? Because if they don't win in either of the first 2 years, then it's a total failure. And if they lose the first one and they lose the second one, then it's really interesting. Guys will leave. If they lose the first one and they do win the second one, then it's really interesting because, hey, can they, you know, you win two out of three. It was a good thing. Like, everything is interesting. The only thing that's not interesting is this. The Warriors go 71-11, win every series in five games, and it's like, oh, they did crack the code. Like, no, you know, good night, everybody.
Yeah. All right, man, to the best part of our podcast, why people listen to us, probably not why, but we're going to go to the gambling section.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please?
Good roll, man. This table's hot. I want some of this money. Get me in this game. Come on.
Sir, you're aware that there's a $50,000 buy-in this evening?
If that's the case, give me $100,000 in chip. Let me have a Diet Pepsi and some hot wings.
Baylor's at home against Kansas. Will they win by 100 or 105?
All right, so we'll go to NFL. Buffalo is a Buffalo is going to Miami. Miami is a three-point dog at home, having come off that big win against the Steelers. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think in that game, even though I don't like taking mediocre quarterbacks on the road laying points, in this instance, I will do that. Like, I don't think Ryan Tannehill will be able to move the ball against the Bills' defense. How about this for a jarring stat? The NFL team right now with the single best point differential is not the undefeated Vikings, is not the Patriots, it's the Buffalo Bills. The single best point differential in the sport is Buffalo. They've won four in a row. I don't think Miami's good at all. Miami's going to have a letdown. I would swallow the 3 points and take Buffalo.
Yeah, I'm with Nick there. I like Buffalo. I think the way LeSean McCoy is playing right now, he's playing awesome. And you could take the running game on the road with you anywhere you go. And I think the way he's playing right now, he's played well, I think really well the last 3 weeks. And that's obviously going to help a mediocre quarterback.
Yeah, I was going to say, run ball will travel. And if you can continue to run the ball like they have, there's no reason why they can't. However, Jay Ajayi ran for 204 and what, three touchdowns?
Yeah.
I mean, it ain't we're not talking about, you know, Emmett Smith, but to run for 204 yards against an NFL team is pretty good. I'm gonna just go against the grain and take Miami at home for the sake. At some point, that Buffalo trend has got to slow down. So give me the Fins because I got 3 points.
There you go, Jeff. You took the Finns, so now I can hop on the Buffalo Bills with these guys. Rex, the Ryan brothers are nuts. We know that. And like you said, guys, the running game is great. I love seeing Rex on the sideline and Rob. So give me the Buffalo Bills purely out of white hair, old man, big old belly fandom. So, okay, perfect. Now, Seattle goes to Arizona. Arizona is a 2-point favorite at home. Very weird line. Cardinals at home after coming off a Monday night game against the Jets. What do you guys think?
What do you got, Nick?
I was way off on this line. I was talking about this today. Arizona's a 2-point favorite, right?
Yep.
Yes, yeah, sir.
Yeah, I think that line's off. Like, I think Seattle's outstanding. I don't think Arizona's very good. I think they just took advantage of a terrible Jets team. Like, again, I'm gonna take the road team. I think Seattle should be favored by 2.5 on the road. Like, now maybe this is one of those where we're all gonna say Seattle, and that's always a risky thing. But when the line just seems wrong, but I think Seattle's one of the five best teams in football. I don't think Arizona's one of the 12 or 14 best teams in football. I'm getting points with Seattle. Like, yeah, I'll take Seattle plus the 2.
Yeah. I'm with Nick, too. I think Seattle should be favored in this game. Not by a lot, but I think they should. Carson Palmer is playing like he's almost 40 years old and he's had two knee surgeries. I don't trust Carson Palmer anymore, and the only good player I feel like on that entire team right now is Johnson, the running back. So give me Seattle. I think Seattle is playing really well, and they're finding ways to win games. So I think that they I think they win the game, so give me them.
So I think this is not a counterculture pick, but this is the two best running backs that I've ever seen in person are David Johnson and DeMarco Murray. And I don't think that Seattle – I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. David Johnson was inserted in the starting lineup last year for Arizona in week 6, correct?
Yeah.
Then I believe one of those games that they played against Seattle was prior to that. So they've only really experienced David Johnson one time. And at 220, 225, 6'1", and can run that fast, there is nothing else in the game that can simulate that outside of the guy they played with, which was Marshawn Lynch last year. And at home – David Johnson is damn near unstoppable. So even though it's 2.5 and it's like Arizona's still favored, I think because of the David Johnson factor, give me the Cardinals. I don't feel really confident about that, but just the fact that he is as good as he is in that stadium, I would feel comfortable taking that over whatever Seattle's running with.
David Johnson, by the way, he's shocked me at how good he's been. I will give him that. I just think that Seattle defense chokes the life out of people.
He was we
absolutely.
We lost. I got one real quick David Johnson story. So we were playing Northern Iowa, my senior year in 2013, and that dude had like 210 yards, and we lost at home to an FCS opponent, which started off the worst season of my athletic career. And I got to watch David Johnson just run up and down the field. It was awful.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with Seattle. I'm gonna go with you guys. Smart money there. That defense in Seattle is very, very good. And Carson Palmer, the one thing that about Carson Palmer that you could usually think about, you know, he's usually a guy that's a top tier NFL quarterback, not turning the ball over, taking care of it, doing the right things. This year maybe he's been concussed a couple too many times, but he's throwing bad balls. He's all over the place with his reads, so give me Seattle in that defense. I think it'll be a low-scoring affair. Last game here, another sneaky one here. You got Washington coming off a big win, going to Detroit to play the Lions. The Lions are a one-point favorite at home at Ford Field. What do you think, Nick?
Yeah, I filled in for Colin on Tuesday, and we had Peter Schrager on, and he made the case that – What are you laughing about?
I know exactly where you're going with this because Peter Schrager is completely off his rocker with what he told you on Tuesday.
Oh, okay. So you saw it. So he made the case that Matt Stafford's been the best quarterback in the NFL this year. And while I think that is a true overstatement, what is true is Matt Stafford has been very good. Like, there is no denying it. The numbers are Stafford's been very good. Detroit also has played a who's who of nobodies. Like, Detroit this year has played Indy terrible, Tennessee terrible, Green Bay fine, Chicago terrible, Philly okay, Los Angeles terrible. I mean, and they play Washington this week and then Houston. I mean, just as easy of a first eight games as you can possibly have. Washington confuses me. I think Washington is okay at everything and not great at anything. I don't love taking Kirk Cousins, but I think overall Washington's a slightly better team. I'm only, swallowing 1 point, or I'm getting 1 point if I take Washington.
Yeah, 1 point.
Yeah, I'll take gosh, Kirk Cousins on the road isn't great.
Exactly.
It ain't great.
It ain't great, as I like to say. I'm trying to – how about this? Is this allowed? Can I just pick the under 49?
There you go.
Like, forget the spread. Like, I don't even like this. I also, and this is maybe one of the reasons I'm a bad gambler, I don't like betting games that I have no interest in watching. And I have no interest in watching Washington and Detroit, even though I suppose one of those teams could be a wild card team. It just seems totally unappealing to me.
So,
I got the under 49.
Yeah, I'm with Nick on this, but I'm going to take Washington. But I hate having to pick Kirk Cousins because I don't trust Kirk Cousins. Because every time I watch him play, it's when he plays the Cowboys. He's not very good. Like 3 weeks ago when they had a chance to beat the Cowboys on a last – they had 4 seconds left of the game. He threw the ball into the stands behind the end zone. And the game – the clock ran out. Like didn't even give his team a chance to win the game. I don't trust Kirk Cousins. But I also don't think the Lions are that good of a football team, and the Redskins have gotten better each and every week since week two when I watched them play against the Cowboys. So I'm going to pick Washington here.
There's just – I don't know anything about these teams. I don't – at all. Like the Lions and the Redskins, they're not on TV in
Des Moines. 4-2 versus 3-3.
They're not on TV in Des Moines. The Washington Redskins. There's one person in the state that wants to watch the Washington Redskins, and it's Steve Prohm, and that's it. Yeah. And so the only thing that I can base it off of is what Kirk Cousins does, which anytime I do watch him on like League Pass or if it's on like Wild Wings or something like that, he makes pretty much solid decisions. Except he's good for three plays a game that you just go, what in the hell are you thinking?
Absolutely right.
I'm gonna say, I'll take the home team. In the I have no idea battle. So give me the Lions just because I guess that's my only option.
There you go. I'm going to side on the NFC North side too. I'm going to go with the Lions. Matt Stafford has been good. Guys, he's lost a little weight. I don't know if that makes him feel better about himself or what, but he's playing better. I like
He's
it.
Playing so really well this year. That is true.
It's because of Jim Bob Cooter.
Jim Bob Cooter. Great offensive coordinator name. Nick.
Great football name.
Nick,
great football name.
Thank you so much for coming on with us, man. We appreciate it. We appreciate the time. You're the man. All three of us are listening to you every single day, every single time you're on. I've been listening to you since your 6'10 in Kansas City days when I was making the commute from Texas to Iowa and back all the time. That's how I originally found you all those years
ago. I was going to say, how did you find it? Oh, okay, you were driving from Texas to Iowa.
I flipped it on there one day, and I forget – the first rant, I believe, was a Mike Vick dog rant. And then after that, one other time, it was like 2009, 2010 when I first found you. Then another time, Matt Castle was the starting quarterback for the Chiefs, and he was pretty bitchy in his post-game press conference. So you went off on him about that or something. I loved it. So I tweeted at you. You followed me back, and you know we've been internet friends.
Been internet friends for a long time. Absolutely. Well, continued success to you. I appreciate you guys having me on, and we should do it again.
All right, man. We'll hold you to that. Actually, so thanks so much, man. Continued success. We'll check you out. Thanks so much, man. We appreciate it. We really do.
All right. See you, fellas.
All right. All right, guys. That's Nick Wright. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Barely Audible on CycloneFanatic.com. Make sure you tune into us each week as we talk all things Iowa State football, breaking down games, schemes, assignments, stats, and previewing Cyclones games. We'll talk to you next week. Go State. Peace.